Hi there, and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years, and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them, and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast series, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds, and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experiences. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. And without further ado, let's get to today's episode. Last time out, we brought you part one of our lively conversation with Rena Maycock and Fergal Harrington. Today, we bring you part two, so please enjoy. Slightly wider question then. Who do you seek advice from outside of the pair of you? And you know, what have you learned from the experiences of other executives or other companies?
Do you know what? That very much depends on what we're talking about. Okay. So if someone were to say, you know, if I had a question around IP, well, I'd go to one person. If I had a question around share certs, I'd go to another person. The great thing about the five-year journey I've been on, and I'm not a technologist, I'm a salesperson, I had to learn the industry from scratch. And doing that, as Fergal will tell you, was going to, a part of that was going to the opening of every envelope and networking like I've never networked before. Now, I do love networking, but I am not afraid to ask people how they can help me and make them meet me for a coffee. And I found that people are very, very good at throwing on the green jersey and helping you. So over the last 5 years, I've built up probably around 20 solid mentors, if I'd like to call them, each of them with a different area of speciality that I can call on, and they'll talk to me no problem, or they'll meet me for a coffee and they'll give me the benefit of their experience. So in truth, it's somebody different for every single problem that I have. But I have to say, I don't think there's anything that I've come up against that I don't have a person to call and give me really solid advice.
And that, I think, is key, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like people will even come to us now and ask us advice, and you're thinking, "Geez, we're only at this a wet week. What are you on about? What are you asking us for?" But everyone looking at different people, you're at different levels and different stages, and people see benefits. Like Rena will get, you know, requests all the time. Will you meet me for a coffee? And Rena loves giving back, and Rena does ask for help, and we do ask for help, and we'll always ask for time. And if people are genuine and people have been successful in the past, more often than not, they're very happy to give their time. But if you start by saying, "I'm looking for something and I need this and I need that," and they're thinking, "God, this one is just out for, you know, blood and money and whatnot." But if it's just time that you start with, then people are more than happy usually to give that. And we love doing that as well. But I know of a lot of people who would be thinking, "Oh, I'm going to keep those to myself now. They're my contacts and they're my connections that I've built up over the years." But we'd be very much the opposite of that. If someone needs something, we'd be straight on the
Do you know that's a thing in Silicon Valley? If you ask someone for help, they'll say, "What's my cut?"
Yeah.
I mean, that is just...
There's no use scratch my back.
Gross, as far as I'm concerned. Like, I mean, it's just so un-Irish. It's just... It beggars belief. But they'll be like, "Oh no, I could introduce you to such and such, and that'd be a really useful commercial contact for you, but I'm not going to do that. Tell me how much I'm going to get first. Mm-hmm. You're going to cut me in, you're going to give me 5%. They look at chunks of equity for introductions.
You know what they say? It's not show friendship, it's show business. That's the idea.
I've never heard that, but I'd use that.
Very good.
You mentioned something a few minutes ago, and it just kind of dawned on me. That whole idea of about being really invested in the business. So, you know, but that idea, that concept of emotional control, when the passion for the business gets too intense, particularly if it's coming to the point where the go, no go has to be made, and it's more likely to be a no go. And yet you're beginning to, you know, it's like that confirmation bias. You only start looking at stuff that's going to make you go, "Yes, yes, yes, no, this has to go." You know, how do you deal with that? And does it take somebody else to go, "No, step back from the edge"?
On a couple of occasions, friends of mine have, that don't work in technology, have said, "Is it time to let this go? Have you set a date for yourself where it's, you know, it's go, no go?" And in answer to that, thanks in large part to Fergal, I've never had to do that. Mm-hmm. It's never been a case of having to put a deadline on it. You know, as a family, we've made significant financial sacrifices for this. We've put a lot of our own hard-earned, you know, tax-paid-on cash into bootstrapping all the way for 5 years. But that excludes the 5 years where I wasn't working, running somebody else's business, and all the opportunity lost for earnings in that instance. You know, we didn't move to the big house that we wanted to. And, you know, we took all of those hits. Usually, and I understand how fortunate I am for that, because we have a good business. Mm. And Fergal was prepared to put the hard work in because he believed in Kilter just like I did to keep it going. But, you know, the early days of startup really are indentured servitude. You know, you don't get paid. Nobody recognises the opportunity lost for your earning potential and all that kind of stuff. And most people get starved out. Mm-hmm. But we were just lucky enough not to have to come to that point. Now, with A Real Keeper, the other business that we just tanked, it kind of, again, that didn't, I think that was kind of a death by a thousand cuts, really, wasn't it? Yeah, it was, it just kind of flittered away.
And at
one point, I think a few bills were due, you know, a hosting bill and a trust death bill and that kind of stuff. And we kind of went, are we ever going to make this a thing?
An intro, you know, and A Real Keeper were too close. And then anybody who might have joined A Real Keeper online was then ringing me on intro's number, 677000 here. I have a problem with the online site that you guys set up. I was like, well, that's a separate company. And so that was just annoying. And so we just thought we were so close to it. But with the Kilter stuff, what people will have said to Ree, okay, so when am I going to have it on my phone? It's like, God, this is a long journey. It's going to take a while with R&D and all the rest. But when people are on the outside, they don't really know the ins and outs. And that's why it's nice when you are married, you are in a relationship, you know every single detail of what's going on. And so that's
and the more assets we got in the company, like when we got the patent granted, when we got the endorsements from all the stakeholders, like the UNESCO stuff and the partnership with DCU, and, you know, you get pilot agreements, you get all these little things, and you're eking towards success. Like you're getting to that point where you're going, oh, you couldn't let this go. This is, you know, you just couldn't let it go. So the more I achieved in the business, or we achieved in the business, the less likely it was ever going to come to a D-Day.
Yeah, but that speaks to the idea that there, you know, as an entrepreneur, there is a real need for clarity of purpose. Like, you know, you have to, there has to be, you know, there has to be the end destination. The journey may be different, right, and different things are thrown at it, but you've got to have, you know, that idea of the eye on the prize.
But no one's going to dispute that protecting children online is not a great prize to go for.
Correct. Yeah. So,
I think we always kind of saw Kilter as being the opportunity to have the big payout, the big retirement, the dream. You know, obviously, we have the impact on one side. We want to protect children from being cyberbullied and groomed and from the mental health effects. But we also see it as a significant revenue generating opportunity and a big payday for both of us. I mean, you know, I don't want to be the chief executive
but they don't
of this
to be
for 20 years.
Exclusive, do you know what I mean?
No, they do. Well, they don't. And that's the thing. You know, with one, you get the other, you know, which is fantastic. Mm. You know, you get the impact and you get the revenue. But we always kind of saw Kilter as that opportunity to kind of not necessarily, you know, get away from intro, because it'll always probably be our baby.
We built it from scratch.
But to free us up from us a bit.
But on that point about intro, right, mm-hmm. at what point do you go, it's better off in somebody else's hands?
You see, the key man issue, and I built this up, and maybe I'm a control freak as well, and I still love chatting to people all day, every day, and booking everyone in and managing the staff and doing all that. We've got a global trademark now, but it's really hard to find people around Europe or the UK that are going to be good enough to do what we do, because no one really does it the way we do it. And we set this up in such a way that in year one, we just opened the doors. We were kind of a little bit naive. And then we realized, oh my God, people are hideous and people are really difficult. And all our friends and family members said,
all people are hideous.
No. But the point is, we opened the doors and we were very naive. And then we discovered all these issues that people were coming up with. And we thought, this is, why did we do what we did? We doubted ourselves, I think, for a few minutes in the middle of the first year, because our friends and family prior to opening said, you're quitting your good jobs and you're setting a dating agency up. What do you like? And so we said, geez, maybe it does sound a bit fluffy. But there's nothing fluffy about it as a thing. And people have this perception of a dating agency, oh, lovely, you know, bunny
they
rabbits and meadows.
Something in his throat, darts at it.
Yeah, well, yeah.
But people think it's rainbows and unicorns.
They do.
When they come to apply for a job, they're like, I'd love to be a matchmaker and make people's dreams come true. It's not that. It's a sales job.
It's sales,
all day long, it is a sales job.
As being able to advise people, you need to listen to this advice and heed this advice and get out of your own way and stop thinking that this is my type because your type thus far hasn't worked.
Mm.
And people are exhausted with online dating. Online dating is what really drives so much business to us because people are seriously tired of the fake profiles and all of the ghosting and whatever else is going on. So, you know, and people have become so dismissive online of other people and they'll go on 20 dates in the month and then they're thinking, God, I'm 39 now and I went out with someone for 5 years and I'm dating all the time, but now I don't really know what I want. Who is there any decent people out there? So we see Intro now as this exclusive club for genuine people who want a long-term meaningful relationship, who just don't want to mess around, don't want to, you know, be have their time wasted anymore. And I love being in control of that exclusive club.
And it is a good business. In answer to your question, we flirted with the idea of selling it.
Yeah, if somebody wrote you a big check,
yeah,
to do all the good work.
If eHarmony wanted to take it, and I don't have to be working for eHarmony, then maybe.
There's two things, though, that stop us. The nostalgia, but also we've got a big thing about our kids growing up to understand the value of hard work and earning a crust. And if you can work an intro, you know, you can work anywhere.
Right.
So we kind of like the idea of when they're 15 or 16, throwing them in at the deep end, get in there now and answer the phone and, you know, learn how to deal with the public, because if they can do that, they can do anything. So we kind of like the idea of it being a bit of a training ground to give them an idea of, you know, punctuality, you know, earning a crust, dealing with difficult people, selling, all of that. It would be a really good grounding.
And having a work ethic as well. I mean, Rina would say in the past, my leg would need to be falling off for me not to go to work. But then, you know, COVID happens and people get certain, you know, bits of money in their account.
Yeah. It's virtually impossible to get people with
a
work ethic.
It's so difficult. Yeah.
So I think if we can bring up our kids with a work ethic, they'll have an extremely strong advantage over their peers.
Yeah.
You mentioned an interesting one there just when you were talking about the start of intro.
Mm.
Naivety, right? Can naivety be an advantage, number one?
Yeah.
And number two, does it only work once? You can't be naive the second time around.
I do sometimes feel ignorance is bliss. But then, if you haven't got the self-awareness to be able to identify the fact that actually I was an absolute fool and I was there coming in with blinkers on thinking, oh, should this be lovely? I'll get Johnny and Mary together. If you continue that way, but then Johnny and Mary are hemorrhaging your business and then you've got nothing to show for it, well then, you shouldn't probably be an entrepreneur. But we corrected it fairly lively and we said, no, we're not a little diddly eye dating agency. We are going to base everything on stats, facts and figures. So we identified the issues and then said, let's look at the CSO and the census results and give people the hard facts. And when they're on the phone, we have a triage. Every day we have a triage with every single person who wants to join. And I say, if you're looking to join Intro, you need to be agreeable to these policies. And they're all based on the main issues that people bring in this country. And one is unwillingness to travel. Another is academic snobbishness from women towards men, and another is age issue. So I'll get like 65-year-old guys ringing up every single day saying, well, because I'm paying you now for this service, I'd like to start a family. So I'd like 35 to 40, please, because I live in Kerry and I lived on the farm all my life. And therefore, you know, since I sacrificed my life to look after my parents, I think now I need an heir to pass my land on to. So will you get me a 35 to 40-year-old? So you can imagine me calling Circa in Rathgar saying, would you move down to Tralee and have a child for John Joe? So the people's expectations, they think that if I pay for something, I'll get exactly what I want. Yeah. So they aren't able to separate, you know, product from service and people from commodity.
Yeah.
And that's what we have to do.
It's a very bitter pill to swallow to have to say no to more business than we can say yes to. But the business wouldn't have survived unless we started to do that.
We became a club.
Very early doors.
But that's the clarity of purpose.
Yeah. Like we know who we can provide a service for and who we can't. And the people that we are better off not trying to provide a service and taking money off people whose expectations we know we can't meet. It's a bitter pill to swallow because we know from a revenue perspective we're saying no to a sizable chunk of money every year, but that's what we realised very quickly, that we can't take everybody on. That was the key piece of naivety.
Yeah. Manage expectations. My friend said to me there recently, oh geez, you're turning away like about 20 people a day. Do you not think you could actually have a side business now for the really difficult ones? I was like, well, if you want to run it, you can. I'm not doing it. But like, you know, it's just from a business point of view and from where people are, are, location is, and we're all in the city centre, you know, we're in Grafton Street, but there's so many living in D2 and D4 and D6 that will call me and say, well, you know, I work there, so obviously I'm going to meet someone in that location. Mm. I was like, well, that's the problem, because there's twice as many women living in urban areas than men, because women spend longer in third level education. That's why there's more women pocketed in cities.
God, he's full of stats, isn't he?
I love my stats, Aidan.
I think, are you getting an understanding, Aidan, of the selling, what I was saying about being a great salesman?
I love when the women, they call me and say, well, I'm only interested in guys, I'm only attracted to guys over 6'2". It's like, it doesn't matter what you're only attracted to, it matters how many guys over 6'2" live and exist in this country.
And are attracted to you.
Exactly. It's a quid pro quo. But there's only 30% of Irish guys over that height. That's the point. So when they start arguing with reality, that's when I say, get off the phone, Fairly Lively, Fergal.
Tying into that then.
He can't switch it off.
I know.
It's impossible.
Have you got a problem with that?
Do either of you have a complacency radar or a complacency sense that you know, you find it, it's very rare to find in entrepreneurs because they're so driven, right? So there's kind of only one gear, right? It might slow down a little bit, but it's only ever forward, right? Whereas, you know, if you're management, sometimes you get that idea that it's just kind of, we get into the thing and we move along.
There have been times, I think, in intro in the past where we've become a bit complacent. You know, there was when you are lulled into a false sense of security around perhaps the people that you have in the business, or and maybe you might kind of go, oh, maybe I can relax a little bit.
Okay.
And then you realise quite quickly, actually, no, we can't relax. I think we've come to realise, and we actually literally had this discussion yesterday, when you're an entrepreneur, that comes with a certain set of responsibilities and they never go away. And it's very, very, very difficult to switch off and let go, because any time we've ever tried to do that, even go away for a holiday for a week without looking at emails, the business suffers. Mm-hmm. So when we're thinking,
drastic,
for instance, about intro, if we don't take 2 week holidays anymore, because when we take a 2 week holiday, it doesn't just cost us how much the holiday costs us. It costs us the significant dip in sales that happens when we're not there, and then other issues that we have to come back to. And that's the same for most small and medium sized enterprises, I would say. You know, when you try to slip into complacency, when you try to kind of believe that you've set up the company in a way that it can run itself, then you get a bit of a rude awakening.
But that comes back to what you were saying, that people need to have a little bit of skin in the game in order to actually care enough when you're on holidays that they're not going to let the whole thing go to.
You need to have that mentality, and whether it's equity or whether it's some sort of
commission
there has to be something.
Still doesn't matter how much you do that. You could give them half of the amount that it costs to join and they'd still not do half the job because they let people go, they let people off. There's not that hunger there.
Yeah.
And some people just don't have that buzz and that thrill to actually get the sale.
But don't forget, we're also expecting people to have that entrepreneurship, that drive and that, you know, that ambition that we have, only without the payoff, without the owning the company, without kind of, you know, having the freedom of the agency.
They need to own the company. They've got to have some sort of skin in that game.
No, nobody will ever have that passion for our businesses.
And we pushed the franchise thing all across and used different companies to do that. And it's just so hard to find, because either people think it's a fluffy kind of a approach, or they don't get the actual job itself. So it's really hard to find people who are interested in doing this.
What percentage of your success would you say is down to luck, and what's down to hard work?
Oh, I don't think we had any luck with Kilter. That was hard graft. With intro, there was one lucky piece, and that was that we got onto the Late Late Show. And that was early in the business. And we still get people will call Fergal and say, I saw you, a quarter of people will say, I saw you on the Late Late.
Which speaks volumes to the procrastination, you know, characteristic in this country as well. And I had a guy who just joined, and he was 48. And the first time he contacted me, he was 36. And year on year, he kept on ringing back. And I thought, I'm a bigger fool to waste my time. My 20 minutes of every year talking to this guy who's probably never going to make a decision. And finally did. But then would have complained to me and said, why can't I get someone who's 33? I was like, you could have when you did it originally, 36. So they'll blame you for everything. But that was luck, and that catapulted us into a different level altogether. Because as seen on the Late Late Show,
yeah, just the business, business exploded.
Yeah.
It brought us to a market leadership really quickly, and we were only 2 years in, I think, at that stage. And that we leapfrogged everybody. So that was a stroke of luck. But Kilter was just chewing.
Well, it was luck, but it was also, you know, it was paying for PR. So.
Yeah, but there still is a certain element of being lucky in that.
Yeah.
I think I wouldn't fully credit it.
When you compare the two, and both businesses are at very, very different stages, so this is an interesting idea. What's more enjoyable, the journey where you could argue Kilter is now, or the destination where Intro is now?
Oh, I think the journey is way more enjoyable. Fergal would probably disagree because he loves the sales side of it. So he gets a buzz from that. But I love the journey. I love picking a point in the future and a goal and getting there. And I love the feeling of eking towards getting that goal. When something is at market and there's not that much innovation to be done, I'll kind of lose engagement a little bit. I kind of need like the constant challenge.
If I don't challenge myself and say I'm going to get 10 by the end of this day or by 3 o'clock, I'm going to have 10 done. If I don't get 10, I'm very hard on myself. So, but if I get to the 10, I'm like, oh yes, I love that. That's fantastic. I really
self-imposed targets.
I love self-imposing my own targets.
So you see here,
he's a manager's dream.
Another good question then is: do you self-analyze yourself and your decisions? I think
Jesus,
the obvious answer
I do.
Is,
I yes, do. I never stop.
And maybe not so here.
I'm very hard on myself, and she's also very hard on me at times.
I'm a bit arrogant when it comes to decision making. I believe usually in my own decisions.
She does. And she loves when I question those decisions that she makes. Sometimes
when I say love, I mean hate.
Hate, yeah. But it's always very good to talk about things, talk things through as a husband and wife and a couple in business. I love talking things through to death sometimes. Whereas Rena would be from the school of, I'm going to mull over that in my head for a night.
I just sort things out in my head.
That
and I don't
drives me insane. And I see the little mice running around her head the whole time. But it's like, come on, we can talk it through and get it done quicker.
Yeah.
So I'm a little bit impatient. She's very impatient as well, though.
In a different way.
Yeah. She's smiling at me here with loving eyes.
I hope in time there'll be plenty of young people listening to this podcast. But before, in case there are a few out there now, what advice would you give, A, to your younger self, and then B, to young people today? So it's a time context.
What advice would I give to my younger self? If I could go back in time, I'd do probably a business degree or some component of finance, because that is, so everybody has an area that they're not, you know, extremely skilled at. I'm not very skilled at it. Mm-hmm. You know, I know what numbers are. I can read spreadsheets and P&Ls and all that kind of stuff. I'd like to have more confidence in it. For instance, with Darcy, our daughter, you know, I said to her a while back, I can't remember what the context was, but I said to her, what do you want to be when you grow up? She's six. And she said, a businesswoman. And I was thinking, yes.
Result.
Mm-hmm. Parenting goals right there. But I'm delighted that she thinks that way. But I never thought I'd own my own business. So I think I went to it a bit late in the game. Yes, I was a chief executive of a group of radio stations when I was 30, but I could have been owner of my own business when I was 25. Mm-hmm. Because I remember when I started in 98FM doing a sales job, there was a guy that started alongside me. And as it turned out, he came from a very wealthy family. And I was like, what are you doing selling advertising? It's the hardest thing you could possibly sell. And he said, well, my dad told me that no matter what area of work I go into, if I can sell, I can do anything. And he was dead right. So what I would say to anybody coming up and looking to own their own business at some point in the future, if you want to be an entrepreneur, you have to learn how to sell and learn how to read numbers. Get into a sales job very, very quickly, earn your stripes, but pick the hardest thing to sell, because then you'll get kudos for it, and then nothing will ever faze you.
I would have started younger, I think. I would have had more self-belief instead of, I was kind of arsing around a little bit in different jobs and different sort of sectors. And I just feel if I focused a little bit earlier and had someone who told me that, okay, well, you're really good at this. Your strengths are in sales and in people and that. You should really be focusing on this. You're wasted in this other place where you're working for next to nothing and getting a little bit of commission if the solicitor puts the sale through and then all that happens. So I think I'd do that because one of the biggest pet hates of mine is procrastination. So I'm looking at people do it all day, every day now, and I'm hearing them and I'm thinking, why didn't you do this 10 or 20 years ago? So I myself probably would have said, okay, I'd love if someone told me at 18, just get onto it now. Why do you have to wait till you're 30 to start doing something else?
Yeah, it is key. When you started out on the various journeys that you went on, what did you think would make you happy or deem yourself successful? And is that still the same today?
My word. For me, it was looking at the numbers and building the numbers, just ourselves. The two of us, I'd be on the mobile phone doing one thing and then I'd get a call for an intro thing and another. So I was multitasking like you wouldn't believe. And I thought, oh my God, when's it going to get to a stage where we can actually just solely dedicate ourselves to this new job that we've just, a new career that we've set up ourselves? So that was what I saw as going to be like success. And then as that grew and we got more and more media and we love getting onto shows and onto different things, and there was a serious amount of interest in intro and in the whole idea of dating. And the more and more, you know, we got asked to do things, I saw that as, okay, the profile is being built up now and there is a belief in it. That's what I felt was the key time when we'd made it sort of as a sort of a couple who had started out and it came into fruition.
I still think I'm on the journey towards success for me. I think success will be, and in fairness, that point in the future where success is tends to keep moving forward. You know, I thought when I started that having a really credible business on Grafton Street that was employing 9 people, I would have thought, oh my, when we started at Intro, I would have thought that's what success looks like. You know, commission on taxation, that's what success looks like. Currency, that's what's it. But that keeps moving for me. Right now, success will be when I'm investing in other people's startups.
Okay. What mistake did you learn most from? And how and did you apply the learnings then?
For me, that would be the mistake that we made with the Real Keeper. I would have gone out looking for investment because it was a good product.
We should have given away a little bit.
We should have just been willing to give away.
We weren't.
Okay.
We were selfish probably.
We should have taken investment in.
We should have taken advice first of all. And then we should have spoken to someone else who knew about online dating sites, and we should have spoken to some of the big wigs and then probably given away some of Intro. Yeah, 80% is better than...
Yeah, because you see, and I think an awful lot of entrepreneurs forget that they see their percent of the company. Mm. They say, I want to own 100% of the company. And I go, well, that's great. You can own 100% of a company that's worth 2 million or you can own 50% of a company that's worth 10.
Exactly.
Which do you want?
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, exactly. You can become a bit obsessed with ownership, and that's certainly where we were. Back then, and that was 2015, I think. But we learned the hard lesson. We lost quite a bit of money, and we learned the very, very hard lesson, and grew up as entrepreneurs at that stage. Because you're right, you're better off owning 80% of something rather than 100% of nothing.
Yeah.
That's. I wish we'd kind of learned that.
But we were probably arrogant. We didn't ask for help.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's a key, I suppose. Again, one of the key learnings that you get as an entrepreneur is the need to ask for help.
We're like, we have this big matchmaking agency. Of course we can do online. Of course we can compete with the big dogs.
I probably overcorrected. I kind of like... I just pick up the phone to people and go, here's my thoughts on this. Is that the right thought?
I don't know who this person is.
I've helped you out for the last...
Another question I think I've asked a few people is, you know, has there ever been something that... You know, either you really a job or something or a role or something that you really, really wanted and you thought you just the world would end if you didn't get it, right? And you didn't get it, but 6 months later something happens and you go, oh, thank God we didn't get that. The old unanswered prayer, you know?
Unanswered prayer. Oh my goodness. God, this is going to sound really spoiled, but I, in my career, I kind of had just a decent trajectory of improvements. Nothing really kind of... There was one job. I interviewed for Google.
Right.
And I got to the... This is early days now. This is 20 years ago. And I got... There was like six rounds of interviews and stuff. And on the sixth interview, I was like jaded. And they were like, what's your degree? And I was like, I don't have a degree. And they were like, what do you mean? I said, I don't have a degree. That's not on my CV.
They wasted an awful lot of their time as well, but not just checking a simple CV.
And I thought, have you guys just totally wasted your month of my time dangling this opportunity? And I didn't meet the entry criteria for it. That wasn't on me, that was on them. That angered me. It didn't, it wasn't kind of the unanswered prayer, but it did anger me. And in fairness, when I look back at it, if I had gone into Google, if I had gotten that job, I probably would be at kind of mid-level, you know, small fish, big pond kind of thing. And I honestly don't think that ever would have made me happy. I would always have gotten to the end of my career and retired and felt like I hadn't achieved what I thought my potential was.
Optimized your career.
Yes.
And yeah, for me, it would have been being approached by a production company for a TV show that I thought, oh, TV, lovely, great, limelight. And then realised actually the content of what it was all going to be about could have been detrimental to the business itself. So yes, that would be it. Thinking, oh, limelight, flashy lights, great, amazing profile. But then no, to the pure detriment of the company, it, in the long run, would not have made any sense. And I'm glad it didn't.
Fair enough. Now, final question. Oh. In the final question book, right? I would love to tell you this was my idea. I actually robbed it off another podcast. But anyway, so I haven't seen this question, right? The person who wrote this question didn't know it was going to you, Per, right? So here it is. Money no object. You can retire at any age and live where? So at what age would you retire? If money wasn't an object, what age would you retire? And where would you like to live?
I'd like to retire when I'm about 55, I'd say. Somewhat, yeah. And
it's in 25 years.
It's in 25 years, yeah, it's a long way off.
You can tell you're good at the date thing.
He's good at the husband thing. And I'd live here, actually. Yeah, I'm a homebird. Right. I'd like to have, you know, a wee house here or a wee house there, but, you know, spend some summer months or something like that. But I love Dublin. Love it. And we've toyed with the idea of moving and, you know, Fergal's family are West Cork. We go down there. And Fergal's brother lives in Sausalito in California. Would we go there? And an answer, I would absolutely have no interest. My friends are here, and my family are here. But not only that, I just love Dublin, love it.
Yeah, I'd always need to be doing something. I think, but I'd like semi-retirement. I would love not to have to do the everyday things that I do. Love to not have to, but just oversee a little bit more. I could do that from today, Aidan, and I could spend a lot of my time in Kinsale.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Well, look, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I would just like to thank my two guests, Rena and Fergal. You've been very good. Don't forget to like, share and subscribe or comment if you enjoy what you've heard. Many thanks and see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.